Well, good morning. Mentioned last week that I went to the Minnesota Horse and Hunt Club last week. And there's really only one reason that I could take probably 8 hours away from my family to be at the Minnesota Horse and Hunt Club. It was my brother's bachelor party. He's getting married in January, destination wedding. He's flying us and 26 other family members down to the Florida Keys. So I'll be performing my first wedding ceremony on a yacht somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico. So that should be, yeah. The Lord's been good to me. But I went to this Minnesota Horse and Hunt Club, and I had no idea what to expect. And as proof of that, I dressed in something like this, and I pulled a fleece over me, and came to find out that at the Minnesota Horse and Hunt Club, you spend the bulk of your time, 4.5 to 5 hours, outside in the cold. And it was about 40 degrees or so, and then the kind of a wind whipping off the different marsh areas. And so, needless to say, I was a little bit cold for much of that time. But it was an interesting picture as I got there. So my brother's kind of gathering people around. And it became quite clear that as we broke off into six groups, six different groups that were going to be shooting these clay targets, there are really two kinds of people represented here. There was the hunters, and they would be reflective of the people that were all wearing some orange. And some of these guys, I mean, head to toe, hat, overalls, jacket, like boots, like you can get orange boots. Flip to that. That was kind of the hunter group, and those guys stuck out due to their blaze orange. And then there's a second kind of group represented here, and they were called the gatherers. I mean, is that not just a kick in the pants? I mean, is that? And so I got put in the group of the gatherers. Probably because I hadn't shot a gun, had only shot a gun one time prior to that. But that just kind of set the stage for the rest of the day. Like, clearly, I was a second-class citizen in this whole thing. And so we go out in these different groups, six groups, and they have two hunters and four gatherers on each team. So you can see my brother doesn't have he has a couple hunter friends, but a lot of his friends are just gatherers like me. And so there's really within, as I come to understand this whole day, we go out and we shoot our, I guess there's 12 stations. And in each station, you get to shoot two targets twice. So, you know, it'll kind of go straight up and you got to try and shoot that. And then one will come across, so you shoot that. And you go to the next one and then one will roll along the ground, you try and shoot that. And then they'll fire another one, you got to shoot that. And so we did that over and over again for 4.5 hours. At the end of that 4.5 hours, I realized there weren't two groups, okay? There are four groups. One group was, and I'll call them Team One, they were like the true hunters. They dressed the part, and they acted the part. They could actually shoot a gun and hit most of the clay targets. My brother was in that group. He hit like 61 out of 100 or 59 out of 100, and that's good. That's like in class, that's like D work, But in hunting, that's really good, you know? So that was one group. But then I found out that there's a bunch of guys that though they dress the part, they can't shoot. Like, they're no good. And so they're like, they dress like true hunters, but they're not. And one of those guys was in my group, man, he's just so looked apart. I'm just like, oh, what a stud. Look at that guy. And by the end of the day, I'm just like, Louse, like, no way, dude, you are bad, you know? And then, in the group of gatherers, there's kind of two groups. I would like to think that I was in team one of the group of gatherers. I'd like to be a true hunter. That means I shot 41 out of 100, so that put me up amongst kind of those guys who dressed the part but didn't act the part. But this was way more, 41 out of 100 was way more than I thought I was going to be able to do. You could say I impressed myself. I did not expect to shoot 41 out of 100. And there were others like me that we didn't come into this day, we didn't have any clothes, didn't have any understanding, but we did pretty well. And so as a result of the way we shot, we would say, yeah, we could be hunters, but we didn't dress the part. We didn't look the part. And then, I mean, there was Team 2 people. They were just gatherers for life. The worst of which shot 8 out of 100. As a way of comparison, my brother's fiance in her first time out, first time ever shooting a gun, she got 8 out of 50. Not 8 out of 100. So 16 out of 100. There was one guy who shot 8 out of 100. Therefore, he wore women's underpants on his head for part of that night. It wasn't my idea. That was just what others came up with. But ultimately, where we're going with this is that in the text for this morning, in this book of Ruth that we're looking at, there is a man, Boaz, who not only dresses the part, he fulfills the part of what a Christian should be. And obviously, he doesn't know anything about Christ yet, but what a follower of God should look like. Boaz looks the part, but then he plays the part. He acts the part. And Naomi and Ruth, the other characters, fit into some of these other camps. I put Naomi in the camp that, man, she dresses like a true hunter. She is in the camp of Jewish people that say, we're followers of God. But different times in this story, up until this point, we've seen her not act like a follower of God. And then we see this woman, Ruth, who, though she's from a different country, a different culture, not of the Jewish people, she really is acting the part of a follower of God. And so we're going to continue on in our study of the book of Ruth. Just so for a recap of those who you might not have been with us or maybe here with family, just given the holiday. The story starts in Ruth chapter 1 with a gal named Naomi, and she's married to a guy. And that guy takes him to a foreign country, Moab, a different area outside of the Jewish region. So they go to Moab because of a famine in Palestine area there. So they do that. And they do that with their sons. And their sons find wives over there. Then all the men die. The dad dies. The two sons die. And so it's Naomi with her two daughters-in-law, Orpah and Ruth. And Naomi is like, this stinks. I'm out of here. So she's going to head back home. And as she does that, there's this conversation between the daughter-in-laws with their mother-in-law. And they're kind of like, we're going with you. And she's like, no, go back to your home. Go back to your people. And Orpah says, all right, see ya. I'm out of here. So she goes back to her people. Ruth says, no way. And let me just read from you. Ruth says to her, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything, but death parts me from you. So Ruth says, no, 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 this is it. I am with you, I am following you, I'm coming. And so they do that. And when Naomi gets back, okay, after this great example of commitment and love and Ruth choosing to go with Naomi, what does Naomi say when she gets back home? The women ask, is this Naomi? She said to them, do not call me Naomi, call me Mara or bitter. And I'm not going to try and imitate Steve. But yeah, bitter, bad. He does something up here, I think. Rar, bitter. But she's ticked. She's ticked. And she says, who does she attribute it to? Who does she tie it back to? It says, the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. And that is why I put Naomi in that camp of, here she is of the group that says, hey, we're followers of God. And here she's pointing her finger at God going, look at how God's dealt with me. She says, I went away full,
and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" She dresses the part. But when trial comes, she so quickly deserts, so quickly gets off and says, "Forget it. Look at how God has dealt with me." And we are going to see transformation in Naomi, which is a good thing. But then that brings us to the stage of which our current text is in for today. Ruth meets Boaz. Ruth goes out, and her mother-in-law are poor. Dirt poor. They got nothing. They have nothing. And so she comes back. And in verse 2 it says, "Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, 'Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain.'" What does that mean? That means that in this generation, in this culture, in this time, people, the rich people who owned the lands were counseled by law, by the Jewish law, to not glean, to not take up everything of their crops, but to leave a little bit behind for the poor. And so Ruth says to Naomi, "Let me go to the field, glean among the ears of grain, and maybe, just maybe, we can eke out a living. Maybe we can scrape by. Maybe you and I, we can make it together." So Ruth does that. She finds the field of a man named Boaz, and they begin their interaction. And let me just read some of the verses, beginning in Ruth 2, verses 8 and 9, that lead up and into our story for today. It says, "Then Boaz said to Ruth, 'Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn.'" It's incredible. He actually not only just allows her to glean, but then keeps pushing grace and gift and blessing onto Ruth. Ruth responds by saying, "Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, 'Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I am a foreigner?'" It's not just that I'm of the Jewish culture and poor. It's that I'm from a completely different culture. And not only are you allowing me to glean, which is what you would have for people that are poor in the Jewish culture, you're heaping all this extra blessing on me. "Why have I found favor in your eyes?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. And how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." Here, Ruth is just flabbergasted by how the lengths to which Boaz would go to communicate care and love and blessing, so much above and beyond what was required of him as a rich, influential landowner. So much more. And that's, again, another reason why I put Boaz in this camp of he acted the part and looked the part, both. That brings us to our text for today. So this is happening. The circumstances leading up to this mealtime are a little bit tough to understand. Different commentators disagree about kind of what happened. But essentially, it seems to me, what makes sense to me is that this mealtime, rather than being dinner, seems more like lunch. That Ruth was probably there waiting to talk with Boaz. Boaz talks to her, and then shortly after that, this mealtime comes. And Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread, and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. And I was like looking, because when you go through these Old Testament narratives, it's like, is there some hidden meaning and what's going on with this and, you know, what's being communicated here? And so I kind of was looking at the come here, eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine, like as like, is Boaz kind of saying, you know, how you doing, you know, like, is he like, you know, making a pass at Ruth? And it's totally not. It's totally above board. It's just it is one of those, again, another example of him just being a nice, kind guy that here, though she, as a foreigner, he allows her to glean. And not just that, okay, he reaches out to her and says, if you need water, take water. I've commanded my men not to rebuke you or reproach you or argue with you. And then he just keeps adding to that. And one of the things that he adds to it is an invitation to come and eat with him. And we don't know all the circumstances, but we know that Ruth and Naomi are poor. And so we do not know the last time that she's had a meal of this stature, of this significance. And so it's a big deal that she was able to come and eat. And not only that, I bolded up there, she ate until she was satisfied. She ate and was filled. And different times throughout the Old Testament scriptures, those words together, ate and satisfied, ate and was filled, are connected to God, God's provision, that somebody's able to eat, and not just eat, but be filled. And so here we see an example of God taking care of Ruth through Boaz. Not only that, she even had some left over, which she'll later pass off to Naomi. Continuing on in verses 15 and 16. So she gets done with mealtime, about lunch, and then seemingly she just gets up and leaves the group to start gleaning. She rose to glean. Boaz instructed his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her. And so seemingly, Ruth exits stage left, and she goes out to the field to start gleaning, and then Boaz makes it clear to his men, let her do it. Let her do it. And last week we did look at the social justice of our Father God in Leviticus. What are the laws? What does it stipulate that a guy like Boaz should do for the people that are poor? It says in Leviticus 19, when you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God. In Deuteronomy, it mimics that kind of thinking. When you are harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands. When you beat the olives from your trees, do not go over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. When you harvest the grapes in your vineyard, do not go over the vines again. Leave what remains for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt. That is why I command you to do this. And so that's what is asked of Boaz. As a follower of God, will you do that? But if we go back to the text from in verses 15 and 16, it says, let her glean where? Even among the sheaves. This is a place where not just along kind of the peripheral edges of the fields, but right there, that would have been the most that anybody could glean apart from those that are actually doing the harvest. That would have been the most drop-off, most excess, extra surplus. What a gift. What a gift for Ruth. And not only that, he commands his workers to work for her. Says, pull out some from the bundles for her. Trying to get at what this meant is just that as they're kind of going and grabbing handfuls and hacking them off, that some of that, and we don't know how much, but he just says, pull out some from the bundles for her. Unbelievable. Unbelievable the lengths that Boaz is going. And that's why I call him the true hunter. He's just the man. He is just the man who is continually going above and beyond, step after step, communicating to Ruth. So Ruth 2:17, We're continuing the storyline here. So she gleaned in the field until evening. That's why I didn't think the mealtime was evening, just not dinner. So she gleans probably all afternoon. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. Kind of begs the question, what's an ephah? You know, like, what are we talking about here? How much? All right. One ephah dry measure. All you chemists out there about it get really excited, like, ooh, measurements, dry and liquid, all right. Equals one bat liquid measurement. Okay, so we're good on what an ephah is? No, okay. All right. Well, in the 8th century B.C., jars from 8th century B.C. were found at these two places, Tel, Beit, Mirsim, and Lachish, with BT inscription. So that's bat. So they, essentially we were able to find out, all right, here's these giant jars. Those equal one bat. All right, so those, if you measure those in liquid, they equal to about 22 liters or 5.8 U.S. gallons. But that's liquid measure. So to get the dry measurement, you equate them apparently to bushels, which comes out to a half to three-fifths of a bushel. You guys following all this? It's what our pastors do. We do in our spare time. We look up all this kind of stuff. And then, what does that equal in pounds, which you and I are probably most familiar with? 29 pounds in one afternoon. I got one wow. Clearly, you guys don't understand the magnitude of an ephah. So let's put it in. All right. So this is probably a couple pound Bible. Okay? So That's that. No, that's not heavy enough. I need something heavy. Coral, you got anything that's like 30 pounds up here? I was going to bring weights, but either I didn't think I'd need them or I forgot them. I'm guessing it's the second one. But this is significant because this is what a guy would make in one day or 2 days. The average wage... did I get there? Yeah, average worker receives 1 to 2 pounds a day. And she walked away in one afternoon with 29 pounds, about. So either a half month to a month's worth of wages that she could go out there. If she were a worker and worked tirelessly day after day after day, she'd get that somewhere in, you know, 3/4 of a month. And here she got it in one afternoon. That is sweet. That is cool. Gal's a hard worker. But that is significant, and I think it points to two things. One, obviously, Ruth just saying, all right, I'm going to take if you're going to give me. And so she takes, but it also shows, again, Boaz's character and his willingness to say, yeah, you can take. Take freely. Take big. It's okay. Continuing on. So she gleaned in the field until evening. She beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. 2:19, and her mother-in-law said to her, where did you glean today? Where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, the man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz. No doubt Naomi was shocked as instead of carrying, you know, a little cup worth of barley grain, you know, you can see just Ruth trying to balance this 29 pounds on her head as she makes her way back to Naomi. And there comes the questions like, where have you been? My God, girl, this is unbelievable. You know, this is going to feed us for the next month. Where have you been? And not only that, then Ruth shows her the already prepared extras of her lunch that she had with Boaz. Great care has been given to her, and it shocks Naomi. Continuing on in verse 20. And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken, the living or the dead. Naomi also said to her, the man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers. And Ruth the Moabite said, besides, he said to me, you shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest. And here we see a glimpse, hopefully, of Naomi's heart softening towards God. She understands that it has been the Lord whose loving kindness has not forsaken her and her family. Midway through verse 20, we see a dramatic change here. After she makes that statement of may he be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. So that is still, I'm just blown away. Here's this huge amount of grain that we have, huge provision. And now there's a transition in the story that's setting the stage for what's coming next. Chapters 3 and 4, which Steve will talk about. But Naomi realizes that this man, there's something about Boaz that's different. He's a close relative of ours. He is one of our redeemers. And so what does that mean, that he is one of our redeemers? There's about five things that one commentator said kind of speak to the idea of a kinsman redeemer. And I'll just list them real quickly for you. Number one, a kinsman redeemer was responsible to repurchase property. If one of your relatives had lost property, as redeemer, if you were able, you were to go and repurchase that property for them. Another one, redeem relatives whose poverty forced them to sell themselves into slavery. It's not that somebody forced them into slavery. It's just like, no, they willingly chose that because of their poverty. Number three, to avenge a killing of a relative by killing another person. Number four, receive money paid as restitution for a wrong committed against the now deceased. So if somebody would have wronged Elimelech, then Boaz could have essentially received some money if somebody had wronged Elimelech, who was Naomi's husband, but is now dead. And number five, the idea of a kinsman redeemer, he is responsible to assist clan members in a lawsuit. So Boaz, none of these really for Ruth at this point. None of these. But yet, look at the lengths he's gone to communicate love and generosity to her. Faithfulness. Hesed, as Steve described. Loving kindness that reflects God's loving kindness for his people. Boaz has done that for Ruth. But so much of it has happened beyond the bounds of what he's required to do. Finally, in chapter 22 and 23, or verse 22 and 23, Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young woman, lest in another field you be assaulted. So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. This kind of sets the stage for what's going to happen. Here, Ruth has this interaction with Boaz. She gleans that day. She gleans a lot. And then provision is made for her to keep doing that throughout the end of the harvest. And not only that, Naomi's got some stuff up her sleeve, which will set the stage for chapters 3 and 4. There's going to be more interactions with Boaz and Ruth. But for today, I want you to reflect on this guy Boaz and the example that he has set. Okay? I want Naomi to be a better example to Ruth than she is. She is in a closer relationship at this point. Naomi is in a closer relationship with Ruth at this point than Boaz is. And so I want Naomi, as mother-in-law, to be a great example of what a follower of God is supposed to be. And she's just not. She comes back and she says, I'm bitter, I got nothing. And Ruth is standing right there, you know. But then here's this guy, Boaz. What I'm calling a true hunter. One who not only acts, you know, looks the part, but acts the part. He doesn't only do that which is required of him, he goes so much above and beyond what is required of him. And as we close, I want to ask you if you're a true hunter. Sometimes in narratives, it can be really tough to pull out, you know, what's that application point? But man, Boaz is a stud. Boaz is the man in this narrative story. And it is God is the ultimate stud using Boaz to communicate loving kindness to Ruth. And if you're not a true hunter, I got good news for you. We've called this series The Gospel According to Ruth, and my wife says, what does that mean? Where are you going with that? Because, all right, was that a misspell? The cool thing about this book, one of the reasons why Steve and Chris and the pastors chose to go this way, is there's so many great, what I would call, rumblings of the gospel. We don't see a perfect description of Jesus. Life, hung on a cross to die for our sins, raised to new life. We don't have that clear-cut description of the gospel. But what we see in a guy like Boaz is rumblings of the gospel. We see a person who goes beyond what is required of him and goes much further in that. And when we talk about Boaz being a redeemer to that family, to Ruth, that is just a shadow of Jesus being the great redeemer of mankind. And so when we talk about the gospel according to Ruth, what we talk about is not just the story of Boaz, Ruth, Naomi, but the greater story. There is pointings, rumblings of which Ruth points to the great gospel in Jesus Christ. And so if you're not a true hunter, I got great news for you. The gospel of Jesus Christ is there because none of us are going to be perfect true hunters. Jesus Christ is the perfect true hunter in which he didn't just name the part, he played the part, he acted the part. And he did so out of love. There was no law in front of Jesus Christ saying, all right, you have to do this. You have to go and die for people's sins. You have to do that. It just wasn't on Jesus' job description. Why did he do it then? He did so out of loving kindness, to display his glory, to do something that we couldn't do for ourselves. Will you pray with me? God, as much as it's exciting to see the ways in which Boaz has worked towards and moved towards and shown loving kindness towards Ruth, God, how much more have you moved towards us? So many of the songs we sung this morning talked about you redeeming us. And God, some of us might just think, that's impossible. How's that possible? It's only through Jesus Christ. Only through Jesus. And during this Thanksgiving weekend, God, help us. Help us to be thankful for the one who has redeemed us. Redeemed our souls from the pits. Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.